What do you recall about the first Kane album?
Well, I remember the cuts were great. I mean, the group was phenomenal back then. Dan was working on the album. We had one company called Custom Laboratories, which later in life, when I become an investment banker, I actually take them public on NASDAQ. Yeah. But at this time, this guy had all sorts of awards for photography, had some incredible people working for him, and he did our album covers. He did Haze and Dudley Riggs, and I'm trying to think what came right after Dudley. But when Kane came, I remember Dan came to me, Dan Holmes, and he said, you know, let's do something for Shock Treatment. He said, you know, can you come up with something? I came up with the idea that if we used the Pound of Flesh theme, for some reason, everybody hears the word flesh and they kind of feel creepy. And, you know, it's just Shakespeare. So, I mean, it's to me, I don't know what causes that. But
this was the name of the album, right? This
is where the name of the album came from. So we came up with this name, Pound of Flesh, thinking, okay, we'll put this together. And the next objective was, can we come up with something for the stores that can be a small display but can still be incorporated in a large display? Because display room for us was impossible. Stores weren't dealing with little record companies. Warner's and the big boys would squeeze us out every place. So one thing led to another, and it kind of got into the can. And at the time that the label was then designed, it got to the point where the shooting came for the album cover. At the very last minute, I remember Gene Tesloff, the owner of the company that was doing the shooting and design work, or the photography, I should say, he called and he said, I got some ideas, you know, if you want to add this to it. He says, how much Shock are you looking for? And I said, well, he said, you ever thought about actually displaying something, you know, when you say a pound of flesh? And we talked for a while, and we came up with beef intestines, guts from something. We didn't know where they were coming from. We just thought, what if you put guts on a table, plate? So one thing led to another, and he ended up calling me one afternoon, and his first words were, I'll never do this again. And I said, what is it, Gene? Where are you? He says, I'm down. I spent all morning getting a legitimate license to be a distributor of intestinal materials for the use of photography from the state of Minnesota. It's now afternoon, and I'm down here. He says, I'm getting a 100-pound sack of intestinal material from a cow, and I'm getting a jar of eyeballs from the cows, but they don't have them in jars. You have to go dig them out yourself, which is what I'm doing right now. I just want you to know I'll never do this again. But he says, you want Shock Treatment? And he says, well, play with this in the pictures. So lo and behold, he went ahead and he had a great shooting session. It got very crazy, so most of the pictures, obviously, no one's ever seen, and that's with some of his photographers pretending they're eating this stuff. But the more subdued was the what you see on the album cover today, which is the pile of... Actually, they were very white and washed out. We had to put a lot of red lenses in there to bring the color back out and make it look juicy. But the effect worked. At the point that we were getting ready to release the album, it went a little further into... the cans. We printed the label, had to call a company in Chicago, and tried to order empty cans. Nobody in the world sells empty cans. Try to talk a company into, but why do you want sealed empty cans for? And we said, we need 10,000 C-size cans sealed. And no labels. Finally, we talked one company into it. So we started getting these huge 3x3-foot boxes of cans at the studio. I mean, they filled all the hallways.
Empty metal cans.
Empty metal cans.
No labels.
6 feet high, you could hardly get to the bathroom. And then we got the printing done on a label form with the band on it and the cuts and everything else. And this was the can, the Pound of Flesh. And then we hired some college kids, which sat there on their rear ends down the hallways, and they were labeling these things all the time. And then we started sending them out to all the disc jockeys.
So it was a promotion.
All promotion. And the disc jockeys loved it. And then we started to send them out and do some teasers to some of the retail. Well, then the idea came, well, what if we, and the album was being pressed at CBS and Terre Haute, and we already had, you know, like the order for the first 5,000 from Minneapolis distributor, and Then we had the depot lined up to do the opening CD night or album night back then. We didn't have CDs. They did an incredible concert that night, and we had the upper area in the back as a private area, you know, very Hollywood. Just before, literally about a number of weeks before the album came, well, then we started another idea that we came up with, and that was a series of recipe cards. And we printed these recipe cards so that you could use the pound of flesh for flesh stroganoff and all these other crazy things. And every week we mailed every single program director and disc jockey in the United States for every underground station one of these cards. And it didn't take long for guys to be calling from every corner of the country going, you know, when's the album coming, getting these recipe cards and cans. And then the I'm trying to think if there was anything else that hit. There was a lot of funny stories about the graphics. George had owned Music City at the time down on the corner of 7th and Hennepin. And he went down to him, showed him the cans, and I said, can I put a display in? He said, absolutely. He says, that would be fun. And it was a restaurant right next door at that time. I wasn't there, but he related to me how he had it out with this restaurant guy because he didn't like the idea. He had this display that people saw as they went into his restaurant next door, and George telling him that, you know, the stuff on his in his window probably tastes better than what's in his restaurant. But and before I did any of this, I mean, I took the album cover itself out to Heilitzer's, and I asked to see Danny, Amos's brother, and went in to see Danny, and I said, you know, the reason I'm here, I said, I'd like to get your take on this album cover we're proposing. And he says, okay, what is it, Wes? And I showed him the album cover, and he starts laughing. He says, what is that, beef intestines? Just like that. I said, well, yeah, it is. How'd you know that? And he says, well, why wouldn't I know it? I said, well, do you find this offensive? He says, no. I said, so you don't have any problem this going in the rack? No, not at all. So that was our final green light, and we went forward with it, and it was beautiful. I mean, within the first 2 weeks, St. Louis blackballed it and made us brown paper bag it. Casey in St. Louis, the underground station, was just crazy with it. And we Cashbox voted it the most horrendous album cover of the year. And we got tons of press.
So you actually had to cover the album jacket with brown wrapping paper?
Yeah.
Before you sent it down to...
They wouldn't allow it. They didn't want it in the stores down there.
Really?
Which was great promotion. You couldn't buy this kind of promotion. The cans to this day, I mean, people are playing with them. I have one near my desk almost all the time. So that's what went on with Keane.
So the album comes out in 1975, and how does it do?
The album did very well. It didn't spread. That was the problem. We couldn't get it spread.
You mean you couldn't get it outside of the Twin Cities? Or?
Couldn't really get the sales to stick outside the city. You know, a lot of that has to do with the touring and coordination. And, you know, back then, it wasn't like it is today. Today, you can't even sell something unless, you know, you're either on the internet or you're actually standing in front of the person. And you might even have the band out in the lobby handing it and selling it to them. Okay. Back then, you really did depend on airplay.
Were you able to get airplay in town?
Oh, tremendous airplay. I don't think there's anybody in Minneapolis from that day and age that doesn't know who Keane is, or for that matter, that album cover.
And they did a follow-up album also?
Yes.
Stinger?
Stinger. I remember the graphics were the lightning strikes.
Mm-hmm. What other artists came out on ASI?
Well, we had Hush, and... Hush was an interesting group. I actually opened Billboard one day, and I saw a full-page ad on Billboard advertising for a record company. Called this manager out of San Francisco, and one thing led to another, and we ended up signing this group.
The band was from San Francisco?
Right. It was one of the Bay Area groups. In fact, Bob Berry is still out there today. He has his own studio. He just emailed me last week. He's got a new group... And he's played with Yes and Doobie Brothers and several other groups like that after Hush. But Hush, in fact, he called me 2 years ago and asked permission to go ahead and release Hush in England, which they did. So they're selling product over in England with it. He asked me what I wanted for that, and I said, send me a free CD, which he honorably did. But at any rate, that was one where they actually recorded it in his studio. He still has his studios out there. I flew out there. We had a big party, a signing party, and I remember I flew through Vegas on the way back, and it was one of those things where you go through the airport and they won't let you through with recorded tape material. They want to put it through the X-ray machine. And I'm sitting there with, I don't know how much a 2-inch reel weighs, but I remember I had two boxes and they were pretty heavy to be carrying around. Boy, I ended up almost getting arrested in Las Vegas because I simply refused to let those reels go through the X-ray machine. And I had these guys telling me there's nothing wrong with this and that. And I said, you know, I said, you don't understand. I said, you don't even know what you're talking about. And finally, they called an officer, and then after the officer, and I talked to him, and he was more rational than the, I don't know what you would call the other guy, probably a TSA guy today. But then they ended up, one of the management people from the airport came down and thought it was silly, all the commotion over these two things. I said, you're going to open them up and look at them, and that's what he did. And he said, good, get out of here. But that almost made me lose my plane, but... some of the things back in those days.
Any other bands that come to mind that ASI
recorded? White Wing was a group out of Grand Rapids, or Grand Rapids, South Dakota. We did an album on them. Did an album with John Valenkity that we never got released, unfortunately. John, 1974, wrote, walking through a grocery store in town, wrote Satin Sheets, which became the number one country record in 1974.
That country song.
Yeah. Jeannie Pruitt put it out, Satin Sheets. But John had saved some tunes and put together his own record, material for an album. And at the same time, our publishing company, Tektra, he came in and joined us, and he and I were working on some of the publishing. That never really worked. Well, it didn't get off the ground, and John ended up passing away with cancer. But very talented writer. He wrote some really great songs, and some of them that should still be out there. But at any rate, we ended up with him. I'm trying to think of, we had a distribution agreement with, I'm trying to think of George. He had Leo Kottke, boy, a whole number, about six different artists that were pretty much solo artists. I can't remember his name, I'm sorry. But at any rate, we signed a distribution agreement with him. So between signing a distribution agreement with him and with Natural Life, starting the gospel label, and then having ASI, our own label, with the amount of material we did, we did come with somewhere on our own label about 18 albums. Had a lot of fun with it.
Over what time period?
This was over a period of about 4 years, 5 years.
All through the 70s, through the end of the
70s? All through the end of the 70s. I look at it and think that we're always waiting for that magical moment. Actually thought we had it one morning, I'll say, with the release that we put out on Babyface. That was another group we had.
And they were from where?
Babyface was from Wisconsin. It was an interesting group. We put a single out. For those that don't understand or know who Bill Gavin is, it's a tip sheet to the record industry and Billboard, Cashbox, Record World, all of those. They watch it as kind of it preempts what's happening in the industry. Radio stations report to it. He keeps track of the ads. And there was one particular morning that I walked into the office. I got the Gavin report and looked at it. Now, if you got a dozen stations, or if you even had 50 stations, you were jumping up and down. And I don't care if you were with Warner Brothers or A&M or Columbia. But we had over 500 ads that week on this record, which simply left me going home thinking, that's it. We finally did it. We've got a hit. We dialed up a couple people real quick for money. Thankfully, they wrote some checks. That week, I called every independent promotion guy I could get on the phone with. In every market, we had a distributor. And whatever he wanted, we just hired him. You're on. The records are airborne. They'll be with you tomorrow or the next day. And we went after this record, unfortunately. And ultimately, you have 10 weeks, you live or die, and it died.
Was that Never in My Life and Make Way Miami?
Never in My Life. Make Way Miami was a fun record. That, again, was one that we went after a lot of easy playing. It was kind of strange. We had huge airplay all throughout Florida. In Miami, all the major stations went on it immediately. And we had a promotion kit made up of sunglasses and suntan lotion and all this stuff we got free from a bunch of manufacturers that we sent out to all the stations. Strangely enough, all the records that we sent to the distributors down there all came back in original boxes. The tape had never even been broken. So here we got all this airplay, and the records never got out to the stores. We had stores calling us, wanting, you know, where can we get the records? We're looking at our books. We're saying, distributors had them for 2 weeks, 3 weeks, 4 weeks, and we're calling the distributors, and they're saying, you know, no, there's no problem. They should be able to get them. And it's just back and forth. And
the reason they couldn't get them in the stores was?
Well, bottom line is the distributor never sent them out. They sent them all back for full return. I mean, when you're a small record company, the sad thing is when you sell a product, you don't actually sell it until you cash the check you get for it, because you always end up with a 100% return policy. So, yeah, that was sad.
So the Babyface album was successful as far as airplay, but not as far as record sales.
Right.
And there was how many 45s were off the album?
There was only one or two, the Makeway Miami. And those guys, they came out here and... they played at a lot of different places. And so, and I'm sure there's some others laced in there, a couple more that I don't recall at the time.
So how long do you and Dan stay together as partners in ASI?
We were partners up until, it would be 1979. What happened was we had the city contact us because they were doing a quick take of the building for a Target store, which resides on that corner today. So they went ahead and condemned the property, and the owner of the property, we simply leased it, and we had all of our leasehold improvements, which were all the recording the walls, everything we had to build in to make this place soundproof that we couldn't take with us, we were supposed to get paid for. And for a while, we were very, very excited about everything. We had John Struthers with us, who had gotten a gold record with Roberta Flack's Only Loving You Softly. We had Rifkin with us. Dan, he had spent a lot of time training Rifkin in for a couple of years, and all of a sudden, you know, there's David, and David is doing some really great things. So we had two really, really spectacular engineers. We knew we had this money coming, so we weren't too upset over the condemnation and quick take on the building, to the point that we went over to Uptown and we were negotiating for the library building that you have there right on
28th and Hennepin.
28th, yeah, right next to the train depot now, or where the rail goes through. And we went in and we had brought in Westlake Audio from L.A., and they even did sound checks on the building, and we had some preliminaries, and we were getting very excited about having that as ASI Records and Studios right in the heart of Uptown and with the team that we had assembled. So all that was happening, and then all of a sudden the owner said, I don't owe you anything.
The owner of the property.
Yep. He got paid, and he refused to pay us. So we went ahead. We hired Oppenheimer as a law firm. Now, again, we didn't have much money because most of our money was wrapped up in inventories. The inventories over there was water damage because the building wasn't looked after. And at this point, I had actually left the record company. I still owned stock in the company, and I still had an interest. But I had left, and I was managing groups. And for a short period of time, in fact, I had Rocking Horse, Chrisendale, and then I had Yanni for a few months. I was working with him on becoming a solo artist. In fact, the last time I met him, he gave me credit for giving him the name Yanni instead of Chris Amalis, which is his last name. That didn't work. So at any rate, I was working this from the side, and what happened is the law firm kept working it. They kept fighting it. He got paid, the Target store got built, And literally, at that point, we lost everything in the studio. We had no business. Couldn't afford to continue with the legal, so what they ended up doing was going pro bono on a lot of it with new guys. Dan then had to leave, and he loved exotic cars, so he kept dealing with exotic cars and things. And so I ended up getting into the brokerage business. I gave up artist management when I was given an opportunity to go into the brokerage business in 1980. In fact, that was May, I think, or July of 80.
So I'm looking at a Minneapolis Tribune article dated August 5th, 1976, and it shows you and Dan Holmes inside the studio, and it says the studio control room has been mounted on auto body mounts to insulate it from the trucks that drive by outside.
We'd be in the middle of a session, and all of a sudden we'd hear a 10-4, good buddy, come right across the speakers.
You mean you would pick up a trucker on his CB?
Yes.
And
the vibration sometimes, but our walls were baffled. Dan had built a studio long before I got there with the same type of baffling they use in the 727s. And then the sound room was actually built so that it was separated about an inch from everything else, and it was on Ford motor joint, so it floated.
This was a large space, correct?
Oh, yes. We used to, for a number of a few months, we actually did one time what was called, I think it was Music on Broadway. And I knew the guys at KQ real well, John Pete and these guys, and we ended up having a line connected from our console in the studio to the board at KQRS. Then every couple of weeks, we would feature an artist playing live, like Steve Goodman or Al Jarreau, in our studio, and we would invite about 150 people in. And we'd have Live from Broadway, or Live on Broadway, that was the name of it. And it was really, really cool because all of a sudden, we'd have everybody there and we'd have, drinks and hors d'oeuvres. And then all of a sudden the doors would close to the studio and the lights would dim. Somebody like Steve Goodman would go on and they flip the switch and we'd be live on KQRS. And we did that for a number of weeks and had a lot of fun with it. Didn't pay the bills, but we had a lot of fun with it. So we had a fairly good sized studio. We could actually get the entire symphony in there.
So out of all the bands that came out on ASI, is there one particular album that you think was the most successful?
Well, Kane will always be the one probably to go down everybody's memory.
The Pound of Flesh?
Sure.
Because of the
artwork. Well, the group was well known. They were well positioned at the time. And, the graphics and everything else, it just kind of piled on.
Mm-hmm. How would you describe Dan Holmes as far as his personality?
Dan was a very very unusual person. I will say that for the number of years that I was partnered with him, that worked with him, between the two of us, probably never laughed harder during those times than any other time in my life. And the crazy things that we did, that were, we had to go down and meet some guys in Chicago to try to get airplay. We didn't have time. We couldn't figure out when we would get down there. And Dan had just, like I said, he liked exotic cars. He just bought a 1974 Maserati. That car was, at that time, some guy didn't want it. It was in delivery in New York. So he bought the car and shipped it through. Blew the engine the first weekend. And instead of taking it for warranty, rebuilt the engine himself the following week because he wanted it back right away. And literally rebuilt it. I mean, he always said he wanted a garage with an attached house. So the studio, the original studio, he built the board, he built everything. From there, of course, we got a little more upscale and bought MCI boards and whatever. But we jumped in his car and thought, well, we have to be back here tomorrow for a meeting. So you imagine jumping in this car and driving all the way to Chicago for a meeting at 2 o'clock and then turning around, driving all the way back. He drove down and I drove back. And I remember driving back. I was going the fastest I've ever gone in a car, because that was the fastest commercial model ever built on the street. And I was doing 165, coming back 94. And I was passing cars that were doing 60 at 100 miles an hour faster than they were going. I mean, it sounds insane when you think about it now. But we had to get back. We had another meeting in the morning.
So did you make it back in time for your meeting?
We certainly did. We made it back in 5 hours. Try that from downtown Chicago. But a lot of things that we did, we made a fair amount, and unfortunately, to do what we were attempting to do, we had to spend a fair amount. I guess I look back at it with no regrets. We actually gave it a pretty good effort. But getting back to Dan, Dan and I had a very good relationship. Dan had some other problems, which led to ultimately his demise. But that was, again, after we had already, the studio was gone. A quick take on the building was taken. So all of our dreams and promises and hopes were kind of dashed at that point anyway. At any rate, he did some really incredible things. There were times he'd want to get a certain sound, and he would, you know, run a cord into the bathroom and run it next door because the room or the hallway or something else. And, I mean, it was just whatever it was. He had more unconventional ways of putting something together, which seemed goofy at the time, and everyone would laugh at until they did the playback. And all of a sudden it was like, well, that's kind of interesting.
There does seem to be a renewed interest in a number of these albums that came out on ASI.
Well, I think he deserves a lot more credit than what he got back then, because he did a lot of things, and he cut a lot of tracks, and always was saying, you know, hey, you know, come on in, I'll show you how to run everything. And it was like, all I need to know is how to play music back. You know, I don't want to be an engineer. You get an engineer, you're going to lose your promotion guy. I always turned him down on that, but I probably could have learned a lot in a hurry.
So looking back at your entire career in the music industry as a musician, working in promotions for Heilitzer Brothers, working for MCA, and having your own record label with Dan Holmes, was there any particular time period you enjoyed more than the others, or how do you feel about that now looking back?
Yeah. No inside jokes. No, there were, I have to say that that whole period of time, all the way through, was really unique. There aren't too many people that can go back through. I mean, I have a lot of stories I can tell my kids. I could wrap up hours here of stories, just band stories. You know, you don't want to get into the fights and, you know, what happened here or there, but, I mean, there's tons of them. And the record company, there's obviously things, you know, you talk about, things you don't talk about, the promotion business. But, you know, and the people that you meet, I mean, the people that I've met, it's an endless list when it comes to people the average person never gets to see or meet. So it's nothing that I regret. In fact, I look back at it and think I don't refer to the first that first half of my life very often now, because it totally changed in 1980, and since then it's pretty much been finance and business. Mm-hmm. So, but I don't regret it, and I look at it as a very unique foundation.
Wes, thank you for taking the time to share your memories with us.
You're very welcome. Thank you for inviting me.
The preceding interview was recorded on November 13th, 2011, at Sunrise Sound in Rogers, Minnesota, and was produced by Denny Johnson and Tom Campbell. The copyright owner of this interview is MiniPaulMusic.com.